Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the daily COVID-19 infection rate in Florida Thursday was 5.3%. Or maybe it was 12%. It all depends upon what way you use the testing data to determine the state of COVID in Florida. Now, these statistics are important because they've been used to justify reopening the state, loosening up restrictions, and welcoming students and teachers back into the classrooms. According to state data, almost 16,000 people in Florida have died from the virus. But the top Republican in the Florida House is skeptical. Speaker Jose Oliva commissioned his staff to review the reported COVID deaths through late September. And that report cast doubt on more than 2,000 COVID deaths, claiming the virus was a factor, but not likely the cause of death. We'll have our co-host Tom Hudson rejoin us shortly, by the way. He is connecting with us as we speak. Now, in a memo to House members, Oliva warned against using the state's death data to make policy. We invited Speaker Oliva to join us today. He declined. But here's the thing. More than 7 months into the pandemic, having clear data on the virus is key to know where it is, how to slow its spread, and how to make sure healthcare resources are ready. So, Florida, we are talking about the coronavirus this hour. What's the reliable data? What does it show about the state of the virus here? And how do those statistics influence our decisions? It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. We're going to begin with Mario Ariza, reporter with the Sun Sentinel. Mario, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Now, you report that Florida is using a misleading measure of positive cases to justify reopening schools and businesses, and that we aren't getting a true picture of the spread of the pandemic. That's the opposite of what the House Speaker is saying. So what's the real story? What's the data revealing?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to give praise where praise is due, right? The state of Florida does put out more statistics about the coronavirus than a lot of other states or countries do. But because we put out a lot of data, there's also a lot of grounds for criticism and discussion about how that data gets used, the quality of the data, and about, you know, who is using it as a support for any kind of political agenda or policy outcome. So that's to begin with. But when it comes to the particular statistic that I've been really digging down and trying to analyze, right? I believe former speaker, current speaker Oliva is talking about the death rates. I've been looking at the positivity rates, right? Which is, should be, or really the question that you're trying to answer with that is like, what percentage of people have the virus on any given day in Florida? And the answer for that turns out to be a little bit trickier than you'd think, right? It should be just a straight up, well, you know, percentage. But what our reporting has shown is that the state of Florida has consistently chosen to highlight a statistic that shows a lower positivity rate than the statistic that other states tend to use and that other organizations tend to use. And that matters because there have been moments when decision makers have made policy outcomes, whether or not to close restaurants, whether or not to reopen restaurants, have football games, put mask mandates in place, because of where this percentage stood, right? Was it above 5% for 14 days?
Right.
Was it below 14% or 5% for 14 days? And if you're calculating it the way that Florida likes to calculate it, and that a lot of Florida's leaders like to point to, then it's been pretty low for a pretty long time. But if you calculate it the other ways that are more commonly accepted, right, it hasn't been below 5% for 14 days. And so that's where at least there is an argument to make for there being a misprision or a misuse in this statistic as a warrant for reopening.
House Speaker Oliva is saying, though, that we can't rely on the state's own data. That's remarkable to have the Speaker of the Florida House questioning the work of data scientists and public health experts. There's quite a bit of daylight between them. How do other health organizations around the country track COVID cases in Florida? You report their numbers are much higher than what we're getting from the state.
Sure. So the state puts out a lot of data on the back end of its dashboard, right? You can go to the dashboard, and if you click the right things, you can get to just the raw statistics. And from there, you can do your own calculations. And you have to look at their data definitions and see what is what. But other organizations go ahead and scrape that data using web browsers and stuff like that. And then they put forward their own calculations. So, for example, Johns Hopkins University is putting forward a calculation that's almost double what the state of Florida seems to be putting out on a daily basis. And you're like, wait, what's going on here, right? These two numbers are very disparate. But what they're in fact doing is that they're measuring the pandemic two different ways, right? What Johns Hopkins is doing is looking at the number of positive people, the number of people who have the coronavirus among first-time test takers, people getting tested for the first time ever. And what the state of Florida is putting out... Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So first-time test takers. And then what the state of Florida is putting out is a little different. It's putting out a statistic. We call it their favored statistic, that only looks at the positivity rate, the amount of people who were positive on a given day, right? And this is a little complicated, but it's the top number in the fraction is the people who were positive minus anybody who's ever tested positive before. And the people in the bottom of the fraction is everybody who's ever tested negative, no matter how many times they've been tested negative. So what ends up happening is...
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying. And there are two data points here, the number of positive cases, which we don't have a shared reality about, and also the number of deaths in the state and the cause of those deaths. I wanted to get your reaction to the House Speaker saying he believes that the thousands of deaths in Florida that are attributed to COVID, he says, might be due to something else.
Okay. So here's what I'll say about that. I want the time to look into that. And I think after the election, I will, because there is a very statistically valid way to determine the relative truth of Speaker Oliva's assertion. And it's to look at the aggregate number of deaths in an area, right? On a given month, at a given time, in a given year, an average number of people die. Did that average number shoot up during the COVID pandemic? And if so, why and to what amount, right? And if the number is higher for a consistent period of time during the pandemic, right, we can perhaps deduce from that there's been an overcount or an undercount. And so that's the statistic that I would be looking at. The Financial Times of London did a great job of this early in the pandemic with statistical models for overcounts and undercounts. But it hasn't been revisited here in Florida.
Mario, stick with us. It's Tom Hudson. Mario is with us. Thanks for sharing your reporting. 305-995-1500. Your questions about the statistics, how the testing data gets communicated, what testing data is included. Mario's on top of it for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. We want to bring in Dr. Steven Rosenberg now. Dr. Rosenberg is the past chair of the Florida Board of Medicine. Dr. Rosenberg, thanks for joining us here on the Roundup today. I'll let the control room know I cannot hear Dr. Rosenberg on the telephone.
I can't hear him either, but it's 305-995-1800. We do have some calls about coronavirus rates and data in Florida. Let's go to Dan. He's on line one. Hi, Dan. Are you with us? Go ahead.
Hello?
Okay, it's one of those days,
Mario. Still having trouble there, yeah.
Yeah, as we try to get this together.
Yeah. Mario, one quick question that I had on this as we explore, again, your reporting on how the state of Florida computes that daily percentage rate. I think it bears kind of going over a little bit here, because on the top number, as it looks at just those people who are testing positive that day, the bottom number, so that can decrease that number, right? And so the bottom number then is everybody who has been tested. So it increased that number. The effect is deflationary, right, Mario? In other words, it pushes that daily infection rate, as stated by the Department of Health, lower.
Correct. Yes. The favored statistic by the state, the one that leaders around the state often tend to point to is by nature deflationary, right? That doesn't necessarily mean it's not valid. It just means it's going to skew downwards because of the way it's calculated. There's another statistic that they put out in some of their reports, but not necessarily on the dashboard, which is called the test positivity rate, which is just positive tests over negative tests, right? And it's this most simple, straightforward one. And that one is kind of the Goldilocks rate that you could argue most other states use, right? Like, this is what New York reports. This is what California reports. And I think it's a valid question to ask. And I did ask the Department of Health straight up, and they didn't answer why this isn't the rate that they kind of point to in their public communications.
Let's try Dr. Steven Rosenberg again, see if we've got our technical issues sorted out. Looks like we have. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to the roundup. Thanks for your patience.
My pleasure.
So you
were... I was listening to what you were saying, and you know, one of the issues is, how do you determine the cause of death in a person who is COVID positive? And, you know, if a person was in a car accident, they're still going to be tested for COVID when they're admitted to the hospital. And if they died from the trauma, obviously it was the trauma that killed them, even though they were COVID positive. But the difficulty is, when you have somebody who dies of a stroke who happens to be COVID positive, COVID infections unfortunately cause vascular problems that can cause a stroke, or renal failure, other organ damage. And so if, you know, it's a 90-year-old who happens to have a stroke and is COVID positive, it may very well have been the stroke that killed them. But when you have a 30-year-old, more likely than not, it was a stroke that was caused by COVID.
So there's kind of two buckets of statistics that we're talking about here. One is that the fatality, the number of fatalities in Florida that can be attributed to COVID-19, or that COVID-19 contributed to it. The other one is a handle on the positivity rate on any given day or any multi-day period. Dr. Rosenberg, you wrote an opinion piece that was published in the South Florida Sun Sentinel this week, calling Governor DeSantis's policies, quote, ill-advised. The governor often points to the State Department of Health data regarding infection rates and fatality rates to support actions that he's taken to reopen the state and reduce restrictions. Is that data reliable?
Well, I think if you look at the history of what's happened with his opening of various venues, it seems to have always backfired. And I think the physicians who co-signed this shared the view that all too often venues are being opened prematurely. The numbers of cases are not being reduced to a level where contact tracking could occur. And we saw that initially with the spring breakers, where the bars and the restaurants and the hotels were open, and there were large, large groups of young kids having a good time, but ended up being super spreaders, not just through Florida, but elsewhere in the country.
And then, but is the data reliable to make those decisions?
I think one of the difficulties is that the data is not consistent, and it's changed several times over the last 8 months as to how they're collecting the data. I mean, we've seen large dumps of 400,000 lab results in one day, which, you know, turned out it was over a period of months. So we really have no clue as to how reliable the data is. I mean, personally, I look at emergency room visits and hospital utilization. I'm on the faculty at the University of Miami, and I get their numbers on a regular basis. And you can see when the number of COVID admissions are going up or going down.
Yeah.
And in the last 2 weeks, we're seeing the numbers already going up.
And you wrote that Florida is at high risk for another disastrous surge in COVID-19 cases. When?
Well, I think we're going to see it relatively soon, because if you look at every opportunity where venues such as bars, restaurants, movie theaters have opened, it hasn't taken very long to see the increased number of cases, typically within 2 to 4 weeks. And then when you look at the number of admissions to the hospital, that follows the positivity rate. And unfortunately, their death rate also will increase, but that follows usually 4 weeks later. If you look at the number of positive cases just in the last few days, it's been going up.
Right.
So, you know, we have leveled off, but unfortunately, we haven't gone further down in the numbers. And literally in the last 2 weeks, the numbers have increased.
That's right. Yes. From the State Department of Health. Is the statewide daily infection rate or a 7-day infection trend or a 14-day infection, is a statewide number useful, Dr. Rosenberg?
If it's accurate, it's useful. It's very useful if it's accurate. But there's always been some question about the accuracy because there's delays in reporting. There are labs that don't report. We also don't know how many repeat negatives there are. I mean, personally, I've gotten myself tested multiple times, just an abundance of caution. I would be really concerned if, you know, by chance I had become asymptomatic but infected. Those are always counted. Obviously, there are other people. I don't know about the sports teams that are getting tested on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Are their results being included in the denominator that would, you know, falsely lower the percentage of positivities? I mean, that's a large number of people that get tested every single day, and theoretically, if the bubble is working, they're going to always be negative.
Let's go to Chris in Fort Pierce. He's been holding here on the Florida Roundup. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. I just
want
to say that I think that it's a really valuable statistic that Mario brought up earlier, comparing the amount of deaths in the time period this year to years previous, because I feel like that gives you a really good window of how this is really affecting people. And when you have people like the House leader that you were mentioning earlier, who found that somewhere around 2,000 deaths they're trying not to attribute to the coronavirus. If they wouldn't have died because of those predetermining factors, they wouldn't be counted in this statistic. So I think that it's something that should be looked into.
Thank you, Chris. Mario Ariza with the Sun Sentinel. What about Chris's point there?
I think that, you know, this is an article I'd love to write, and I'd love to, you know, get somebody who's really good at math and help me figure out the aggregate death numbers. But I do think we have to not necessarily, or I think there's an argument to be made for thinking about COVID not just as something that kills you because it infects you, but as something that really affects society's ability to treat the sick, right? So the whole death total for COVID, for people who didn't seek continuing care for their diabetes or for their heart condition because they were too afraid to go to the hospital, for deaths on the highway because people were speeding during the lockdowns. Putting that all together and getting a picture of just how many extra people died, of just how much extra suffering that there was because this virus occurred, I think is going to be really important for the record. And that's what the aggregate death totals would show. I can imagine that the argument that Speaker Oliva is making in certain instances may be very valid, but I don't necessarily think we have a good enough understanding of the virus to establish, like, the causality. Like, did this person die because they had a stroke from the virus, or did the virus cause enough of an issue with their heart where 3 weeks later down the line they were going up the stairs and gave themselves a stroke, right? Like, we don't know the virus that well. We're still getting to know it.
This is a moving target. Well, I want you to hang around with us as we continue the conversation. And still to come, everyone, more of your calls and tweets. Then later, how are voters in Florida's critical I-4 corridor feeling about this election? This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Stay on the line. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about COVID-19, the coronavirus in Florida, the state of the infection, and all of the data that folks are looking at to try to make decisions about themselves, their families, and their communities. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Or you can send us a tweet at Florida Roundup. Mario Ariza is still with us, a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Dr. Steven Rosenberg is the past chair of the Florida Board of Medicine. Another doctor is going to join us here now, Dr. Lang in Lake Mary, a listener there in Central Florida. Dr. Lang, welcome. What are you doctor of?
Yeah, well, I was doctor of educational research, data analysis, and measurement for a little over 40 years. I'm now retired. My comment really is about the data. You know, I often hear people say data speaks for itself. I always make the point that data is really dumb. Data doesn't speak. Everything that we know about data is interpretation. And I know of many cases where I've worked with the federal government, I've worked with state government here in Florida and other places, and I know of many government officials, politicians, who hire researchers to do a study to support their own position. I'm afraid to say, you know, that some of us are for sale and have been in the past.
What do you make of the state data, though? How are you using that yourself as a data scientist and a community member at Lake Mary?
I'm not at the current time. The problem I have is knowing what I know about the state legislature in Florida, having worked with them throughout several years, I don't trust them. I place very little confidence in what they say. I've had to ask for a generation of large sets of data, and I kind of embarrassed them several times because in major state meetings I pointed out that their data could be interpreted in many different ways, and sometimes deliberately falsified.
Dr. Lang, I appreciate you listening and calling and sharing your perspective. 40 years of data education there with Dr. Lang in Lake Mary. Dr. Rosenberg, what about his broader point there, though, that data is dumb? It's the analysis that matters. So, you know, how would you grade, I guess, the analysis that's being done on a daily basis on behalf of the people of Florida?
Well, it's been unpredictable, and I think that's part of the problem is trying to interpret data that there's very little confidence in. I think also we need to have a national standard because you typically see these maps and show different geographic areas that are hot spots versus other areas. The only really consistent thing that we've been able to look at is ICU capacity, and when you see one state or another that has no ICU beds and people waiting in the corridors and refrigerated trucks coming in as temporary morgues, you know that there's a real problem in those particular states, and we've had that here in Florida. But sometimes, even when that's occurred, the data didn't look so bad. They said, oh, we still have empty beds. Well, the empty beds were in the hallways, not where they belong. And so I think the data really needs to be more consistent from one state to the other. But, you know, we were talking about mortality before as a statistic. But one thing that we haven't really gotten a handle on is morbidity. And recently there was a study that showed that 50% of people who were hospitalized have ongoing neurologic problems, including foggy memories and things along those lines. And there's some concern that even children who may be otherwise asymptomatic may have some ongoing neurologic problems. So I think there are a lot of issues that still need to be looked into. This is a new disease for everybody, including the scientific community. And we just don't have a good handle on all of the different complications and problems that we tend to want to quantify.
Dr. Rosenberg, you're echoing the point Mario made a minute ago. As we try to get our arms around the data tracking COVID cases and deaths in Florida, that's what we're talking about right now here statewide on the Florida Roundup. It's 305-995-1800 to join us, getting your calls from all over the state. Mike is in Orlando. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my question is concerning the delay between the date of a death and the date that the death is reported, because Florida does report both of those dates in their data. And over the last couple of months, I've seen that the average delay has increased from about 5 days to about 35 days. And it seems to me that this is a way that could obscure trends in the data, and it could make it look like the death rate is decreasing faster than it actually is. So my question is about whether that's something that the experts think is being done intentionally, or is there like a benign reason for that?
Yeah. Thanks for that, Mike. And Mario Ariza, certainly people looking at the data and comparing the way Florida's doing it to the way other states and other health organizations are looking at this disease, some people might see a benign difference. There are those who are cynical and think, oh, you know, the state is deliberately obscuring these rates. I'd like you to be really clear about this, that you have studied this extensively, written about it. What about Mike's question? And what's your response to the listeners out there who are raising the concerns in their minds? They believe the state isn't being transparent enough about the true rate of COVID that we are experiencing.
It's a great question. I am a firm believer that one should never ascribe to malice what can be explained by, and I don't necessarily want to use the word incompetence, but difficulties, right? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of data. It's a lot of numbers. And what the real picture may very well be is that there are people in the Florida Department of Health who are doing their jobs and burning their eyebrows on their computer screens to try and get this data out. And that there may be, you know, political level decisions made that they don't have control over that determine how the data gets presented. We don't necessarily have reported evidence of that, though we are working to get it. So I'd say that, you know, the judgment on that, I can't answer the question one way or the other, but we have to answer it first with charity and then with hard facts.
Yeah, and Dr. Rosenberg, I have one for you, sir. In the op-ed you and other physicians published, you called on the governor and state leadership just to do more overall to bring down the rates of COVID-19. You published this in the context of an intense presidential campaign where we have both President Trump doing large rallies in the state and Joe Biden visiting the state. The rallies were maskless, the ones the president conducted. We did see the governor high-fiving a lot of attendees at a rally in Sanford Monday. And so what about that aspect of this, how the politics and Florida's status as a swing state that's being closely watched is intertwined with the way the state is responding to COVID-19? Your thoughts?
Well, it's unfortunate that politics seems to have gotten in the middle of this pandemic. And, you know, just listening to Chris Christie yesterday saying, you know, he made a mistake by not wearing a mask. And here you have a Republican governor who is closely tied with the president. And he's recognizing that he should have worn a mask. He encourages people to wear a mask. And he's also telling people this is a serious virus and people shouldn't assume it's just a trivial problem. So I think it was encouraging for someone like him to step forward and make that clear. But, you know, you can also look at states like Arizona that were having ICUs that were over capacity and horrendous problems. And finally, the governor said, you know, it's time for everybody to wear a mask. And they were able to reduce the incidence very quickly by 75%. That should send a message to the people in Florida that we can get this pandemic under control if people would just limit some of their activities. I hear all sorts of excuses why people can't wear a mask properly. I find it interesting when I go into the stores and I see families, and the young children have no problem wearing a mask properly. It's usually the husband who has the mask below the nose, you know, and clearly this is a virus that has access to your lungs primarily through your nose, in or out. And so, you know, I think that we need to do a better job of making sure that people understand the value of wearing a mask and that it's not a political statement, just, you know, whether you're wearing one or not. Again, we can get this pandemic under better control also think that, you know, when you look back at when there was the shelter-in-place situation in March and April, it was somewhat arbitrary, and people lost their jobs. I could never really understand why Marshalls and Ross and TJ Maxx needed to be closed when a store like Costco and Walmart, because they sold food, could stay open and sell clothing. I think that, you know, there are ways to minimize the number of people that are in any one venue at a time. And even with restaurants, if there's better ventilation, maybe just putting big fans in to move the air about a little bit better. But to just go with 100% occupancy in restaurants where you know people are going to be in a confined space without a mask on is looking for trouble.
Let me squeeze in one call here before we've got to let you guys go. Michael in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, I read a couple of months ago that the state of Florida, when determining the death rate, were not counting people who are snowbirds. In other words, people who have their primary residence in other states but also have residence in Florida.
Yep, good question, Michael. I'm just going to interrupt quickly because we're short on time, Michael, but I want to put that to Mario. How is the state reporting those fatalities between residents and non-residents?
That's a great question that I'm going to have to check in on. I know that we divide residents and non-residents when we put out the data for infections and for hospitalizations.
Yeah.
I suspect that we are doing the same thing for death, but off the top of my head, I cannot be 100%. Sure.
Dr. Rosenberg, does that distinction matter in Florida?
Well, if they contracted the disease here, I don't think it matters. I mean, it should be included as a Florida infection. But I was also advised that in some of the universities, like up in Tallahassee, that if a student tests positive but they're from another county, it counts as a COVID infection from the county where their primary residence is rather than they actually are contracting it in Tallahassee. And I think that's another item that we need to look into.
Final comment here, Dr. Rosenberg, in our final seconds here. The state of the virus in Florida, under control, it is under some state of control. How would you describe it?
I think we've had plenty of opportunities to get it under better control.
Mario, what is the data and the data scientists you'd speak to say about the control mechanism?
Well, I mean, at the moment, it's state, like we're pretty much wide open in terms of regulations and like what the government is telling us to do. And,
right.
And things aren't necessarily shooting up as quickly as they could because people are making the everyday individual choice to wear the mask, to socially distance, to not participate in risky activities. So it's Floridians who are choosing to not let the virus take over rather than, you know, leaders telling them what to do.
People making their choices, to wear masks and distance,
Mario, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your sharing your reporting. Mario Ariza with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Dr. Stephen Rosenberg, thank you for sharing your expertise as well on this Friday with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Rosenberg, past chair of the Florida Board of Medicine. And you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Well, voting for the 2020 election has been underway now for a few weeks. Did you notice that? Already more than 2.2 million vote-by-mail ballots have been returned across the state of Florida. Remarkable. That is 80% of all of the vote-by-mail ballots that were cast during the election in 2016. Here's what we know so far. About twice as many Democratic voters have sent back in their ballots compared to Republicans.
And all year, our partner stations here on the Florida Roundup have been amplifying voices of voters across the state's crucial I-4 corridor. As voting continues, we're checking in with those I-4 corridor voters about the state of our democracy in their own words. Today, we meet Michael Weinbaum of Winter Garden. He says the pandemic and how it is affecting his school-aged kids is influencing how he looks at government and voting.
My kids are in Orange County schools, and they basically, instead of forcing all the parents to do the same thing, they basically gave parents three options to pick from. So that was very accommodating. But you hear other things, like at the state level, you hear that the governor tried to force all schools to open. that kind of inflexibility doesn't give me a lot of confidence. We have one kid who's over kindergarten age, and she's in person, and she wears a mask the whole time, and her desk is separated from the other kids, and not all of her teachers are there. She has a teacher there, but she also has Zoom meetings with other teachers while she's sitting in the classroom. I would like to see people elected who care more about regulating growth so that traffic problems and overcrowded school problems and water problems aren't as bad in the future, that, you know, the economy's on kind of on pause anyway, and take this opportunity to kind of get it going again, but on, you know, a little more sustainable terms, hopefully. I've lived in Winter Garden now for 7 years. I don't think I've ever had a contested race for Winter Garden City Council. I think there's been a contested race for mayor once, but the incumbent won it in a landslide. This is a small little town, and the people we have running it are mostly retired. I know at the national level, we're really constrained by excess partisanship. So I just try to look for people who, you know, they have a party label, of course, but they are trying to make independent decisions on their own. And even decisions that independents and the other party might support them on, even a little bit. But it's hard to find such people because, you know, they can talk one way when they're trying to get in office and then just disappear and only do what the party tells them to do once they are in office. I have to admit, I've never really needed to vote. Like, my rights and my ability to get a livelihood's never really been in question. I know that those could be in question at any time. I know that the fact that I voted is a matter of public record, and I like that the people who might be making decisions can see, oh, this guy votes, you know, and even though he's not maybe angry right now, he could, you know, we should consider his feelings and his needs as we make a decision. Even our best politicians are very cynical, and even though they're supposed to consider the needs of the whole community, they're really only considering the needs of the people who vote.
That was voter Michael Weinbaum in Winter Garden. Our thanks to Dinara Prevost from our sister station WUSF for putting this together.
And in a moment, the Gators bench their football team after a cluster of positive COVID cases. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening and for supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, college football is coming to a screeching halt in many stadiums this weekend. You guessed it, thanks to COVID-19. Did you hear about Nick Saban, one of the best-known college football coaches in the nation? He tested positive for COVID this week. So did at least 19 players at the University of Florida. Tomorrow's UF game against LSU has been postponed. We also found out today that FIU is canceling a game this weekend due to a COVID outbreak. So here's our question. What are your thoughts about college sports being sidelined because of COVID-19? It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup as we welcome Peyton Titus, a sports writer with the Independent Alligator in Gainesville. Hi, Peyton.
Hi.
It's so good to have you on the show. You did first break the story at the Alligator that as many as 21 football players and a couple of assistant coaches in Gainesville have tested positive for COVID. Do they know the source of the outbreak?
Well, first, I just want to make a quick correction. I broke the news on Tuesday that the team had at least 19 positive cases. That 21 number was given to the media by Athletic Director Scott Strickland at a press conference on Wednesday, where he confirmed the postponement of the game. As of right now, though, there's not a clear concrete idea as to where the outbreak stemmed from, but there are thoughts that the travel to Texas A&M might have been the source of the outbreak, because after that trip, guys started coming to trainers saying that they were experiencing symptoms.
And did the team practice on Monday knowing that there was a positive cluster? There has been some reporting looking at that possibility.
Yeah, so I think one of my colleagues, Zach Goodall at Sports Illustrated, actually wrote an article about that. The media gets testing updates from the athletic department, which not all schools do. But they gave us a table saying that UF had five new football positive cases on the team as of Monday the 12th. So it is looking like they did practice on Monday knowing that guys had, or that there were five positive tests on the team. But the higher number that I reported the next day could have been found out the following day or later on Monday because of the fact that they were doing daily testing from the time that they returned to Gainesville through that point.
Okay, and we'll continue to learn more about this as it unfolds. But, you know, before football got canceled at UF and other schools, the head coach of the Gators, Dan Mullen, had been pushing for more fans to attend the team's home games. Governor DeSantis has been calling for packed sports stadiums around the state. What's the response now at UF in light of the fact that we have this cluster? And there's been criticism about allowing people in large numbers to watch sports in this pandemic.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation for the university and department because I think from the student perspective, a lot of people are upset about the fact that they're not able to walk at graduation because of the pandemic, which is totally founded. But the athletic department and the university are kind of, they're separate. So the people making the decisions about the stadium are not the same people making the decisions about graduation and in-person classes and things like that. So the community in Gainesville is not too pleased about Dan Mullen's comments. And he did end up taking those back, I believe, on Wednesday in an SEC media call saying that he was kind of just frustrated with the loss and that he realized that he might have offended people and wanted to apologize for that.
SEC sports fans, give us a call, 305-995-1800, as COVID benches football in Florida. Any word, Peyton, on what this might mean for the Florida-Georgia game? It's scheduled for November 7th in Jacksonville. It's always called the world's largest outdoor cocktail party. There might not be a lot of partying this fall, though, due to the pandemic. What do we know?
Well, I'm not really sure how this outbreak's going to affect that game, considering that it's a little bit further along. I do know that the next priority is monitoring the Gators game against Missouri, which is supposed to be October 24th. So depending on how many more tests they get back with positive results and how long individuals are going to have to quarantine, that game could also be in jeopardy. So I believe Scott Strickland, the athletic director at UF, said that he was going to be in contact with the conference and the Missouri athletic department to monitor the status of that.
And we lost you just for a second. Go ahead, Peyton.
They were supposed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead.
So I do know that the athletic director and the athletic department at UF are going to be monitoring the situation and keeping in constant contact with the SEC and Missouri because they also had a game postponed or canceled this weekend that they were supposed to play against Vanderbilt because of an outbreak over there as well.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Peyton, it's Tom Hudson. Wondering what has been the protocol for UF football? You talked about the frequency of testing. How have they been testing the team and the staff? How frequently, given the travel that the team had been in September?
I believe before this week, the team and the program were testing everybody at least three times a week. But since they got back from College Station, they've been testing guys every day. And I believe that they're continuing to do daily testing until they feel like it's no longer necessary. So they've been doing daily testing since Sunday.
Since they came back and obviously found this cluster. And so is the timeline for those players and coaches that have tested positive, and what's the protocols for them? Are they isolating on campus, off campus, alone in some kind of university provided facility?
I'm not entirely sure on the details of the isolation, but I do know that they're abiding by CDC guidelines. So I think that people are quarantined for a minimum of 10 days, depending on how their preceding test results look. So if people tested positive one day and then they test negative like the next day or a couple of days later, then those guys wouldn't have to necessarily quarantine for the full 14 days that we are usually told. So it really just depends on how things unfold over the next few days, I think.
And, you know, over at FSU, the coach there, Mike Norvell, also tested positive for COVID last month. He's taking a pay cut of nearly $1 million. So, Peyton, I'm wondering, as you cover this outbreak with the Gator football team, how this might ultimately affect UF's bottom line campus culture in a school where so much of the identity is built around the Florida Gators and the Swamp. And now we see this cluster with the athletes. How is that affecting the climate on campus and campus operations?
I think everybody is pretty bummed out because, you know, you don't like to hear about any of your peers testing positive for this virus. So that in of itself is kind of tough to hear and tough to report on. But it's also people are kind of shaken up as well about the limited amount of football that they're getting this season and possibly going to games in person or not going to games in person because, you know, they're used to 7 home games a season and being able to tailgate on campus near their dorms or across the street at the restaurants that are on University Avenue. And it's just not feasible this season. So I think it's definitely, I was at the first home game, the only home game that UF's had so far against South Carolina. And in my recap of that game, I wrote about it felt like I was in a Twilight Zone or Black Mirror episode with all the cutouts in the stands and only 15,000 real people there. So it's definitely kind of eerie.
Yeah. Peyton, hold the line here. Matthew in Bradenton's calling in. Matthew, go ahead. You're on the radio. I got about 90 seconds.
Hey, I'm a student at US, and I just wanted to say that I think it's a little ridiculous that we're even considering having fans at the stadium when students aren't allowed to have like a graduation ceremony. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, appreciate that, Matthew. Echoing Peyton, one of the observations that you made earlier. And is this going to, I suppose, how does this color what is left of the season in terms of the potential of fans in the stadium?
Yeah, I believe that Scott Strickland was saying that as of right now, that number's not changing yet. At some point, it will change eventually, not necessarily this season, though, because, you know, we hope that we'll be able to return to normal at some point ever. But as of right now, they're sticking by that 17,000, 20% capacity cap at the Swamp.
And what about any other athletics for UF here during the fall? Any other ripple effect?
Well, before the football team had any issues, I think back in September, the lacrosse team had about 30 positive cases. And they had, on last year's roster, I believe they had 38 people on the team.
Teammates,
so,
yeah. Peyton, we've got to leave it there, but thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us here on Florida Public Radio. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Peyton Titus, sports writer for the Independent Alligator at University of Florida in Gainesville.
And COVID affecting just about every aspect of life, as we learned today here on the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, Director of Radio Ops at WLRN is Peter Mertz. Richard Ives is our Technical Director. Leslie Ovalle answered the phones. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.